everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. I'm so happy to bring someone back on the program that I haven't spoken to in 9 years. Simon Lester, who founded the company Pascha, the chocolate company that I believe in, the products that I love and trust. Welcome, Simon.
Thank you.
I don't want to go too deeply into the origin story of Pascha. I'm going to link the original interview because it's fascinating. But just really briefly, I understand you worked at Cadbury and you learned about chocolate making. And then you discovered that there were things in chocolate in general that some people had very bad allergic reactions to, someone in your family, in fact. And then you figured out how to create chocolate that didn't have anything in it, or at least didn't have any problematic ingredients. And one of the things that many people don't realize, and maybe we could talk a little bit about this to start, is this thing about may contain trace, blah, blah, blah. So it's relatively new that that's been added to food labels because more people are having allergic reactions to more ingredients and they think a product doesn't have something they're allergic to and then they have a bad reaction. And it's because chocolate, as an example, is often made on a machine that makes many different products with different brands. So if there's a dairy chocolate manufacturer that makes their chocolate, and then the vegan manufacturer comes in because they're a small company, they can't afford their own equipment. They'll wash it somehow, but there's still traces. And I was just talking to someone yesterday. I'm an actor. I'm in rehearsals for a show, and this young woman, I brought in vegan cookies, and she was really happy because she could have them. And then she told me she had a dairy allergy and had a tremendous, just a horrible reaction to dairy at some point. And then she started reading labels and she learned about these trace amounts of dairy. And it's not just dairy, it's other things. So with that, you can tell us about your clean chocolate.
Yes, I mean, you've raised a fascinating point because there are sort of three standards. There's does contain, and it's because it's listed as an ingredient. There's may contain, and we'll talk about that in a second, and then there's free from. And free from mean, which is not a legal term, but legally, if your product contains an allergen, you have to say so, like a milk or a nut, you have to say so. And if you do not say so, then it might be interpreted that it does not contain. What we do is we specifically state that our products do not contain any of those top allergens. And the only way we can be sure of that is because we make the chocolate in a facility where all of those ingredients are literally prohibited. Cleaning the line is not sufficient. So you have to never have those ingredients in the plant. The chocolate making process, it's just a very it's an interesting process. It's a very difficult thing to clean a chocolate line. It's too difficult, too expensive, too time consuming to do a complete sterilization and washdown of that line after each production run. No chocolate company can do that. So if you want your products to be truly free from, then they have to, you know, that ingredient must never be in that plant. And that's how we operate for the Pascha chocolate line. I don't think I've actually told you this, but we have now recently introduced a new line, a second brand, which is called Lovo Chocolate, L-O-V-O. And Lovo is not a free from brand. It's actually a line of milk chocolate made with alternative milks and made with plant milks. Most of those plant milks come from nuts. So we on that label, and we don't make them in the same factory as we make the Pascha line. It's made in a completely, actually a separate country. We make them in Switzerland rather
than— That's far enough.
It's completely removed. So on the label, we declare, you know, we've got an almond milk one, for example. So we declare contains almonds. But that factory also makes milk chocolate on the same line with dairy milk. So we also state on the label, may contain milk. Now, generally, it doesn't. There is really no milk in that. There could be a tiny, tiny trace element. But we have to state that it may contain because somebody, who has a dairy allergy should read it, should understand that it may contain. The problem with that may contain statement, which we have to make, we're happy to make, what does it actually mean? Because there's no standard. There is no limit of what that actually could be. And there are, some instances that I'm aware of in the last year, not in the US, but over in, this was Australia and New Zealand, where very high levels of peanut were found in a chocolate bar,
Which can be deadly.
which can be deadly, but the label stated may contain peanut. And it did contain peanut, but it contained, a relatively high level of peanut. In fact, that product got restricted from sale in Australia and New Zealand. But it's an interesting question because what is that limit? What should the limit be? Should this category even exist? Should the manufacturers actually know you've got 10 ppm, you've got 200 ppm, whatever it is, and
I'm
then
thinking of
it should be on the
right.
label.
I'm thinking of trans fats, for example,
Right.
where if there's less than 0.5% or something like that, you don't have to say that there are any trans fats, but that's by serving. And nobody even thinks about a serving, and they can make a ridiculous serving size.
Absolutely.
So
Absolutely. And then
people are getting the trans fats.
people sort of, they get hungry or whatever, and they eat twice the serving size, and then they've got a problem. I think it's a really interesting, area. With our new brand logo, which has the may contain, we don't do the analysis because we don't have to. So I don't know what the true level of that dairy might or might not be, but if there was a standard in place, then I would need to know. We'd have to measure it, and know that we could, accept or reject a bat because it's above or below that standard. But when there is no standard, what do you actually do? And potentially, you can get relatively high levels, as this situation in Australia had, and there were some anaphylactic reactions because people, we're almost asking too much of consumers. We're asking them to make sure they've read the back of the label. But is that really, is that really what people do? Some, yes,
Well, some
but the little
yes.
kid comes along, oh, he just wants the chocolate. He doesn't read it, doesn't read the label, might not even understand it if he did. So he just eats it. So I think, you could make an argument for greater consumer protection in that area. But yes, back to your original point on the Pasha line, we just, rigidly, none of those ingredients ever go into the plant. So we just have 100% knowledge that we are just completely free of, all of those allergens, which is, we call it the kind of the gold standard of allergen free. But if you have an intolerance or an allergic reaction to some of these things, you need to know that it's completely free of whatever it is that you're allergic to. In particular, because the way food allergies work, and I don't understand enough about the science of this, but as I do understand it, an individual's reaction to some of these ingredients is not a constant through time. So depending on the stress levels of the body or the circumstances you're in at the time, a given amount of an allergen might be okay for you on a Monday, but on the Friday, the end of the week, it might not be okay.
Wow, I hadn't heard that.
So it's a very tricky situation to try and manage. We have that in my own family with my children, and I personally, I've got a dairy intolerance, and I find it varies at different times. It's quite bizarre.
Now, there are a lot of chocolate companies out there, a lot of small chocolate companies. I'm sure you know if you have any competitors. You don't have to tell me, of course, who they are. But when we first spoke, you said you couldn't find a chocolate manufacturing facility that was free of allergens. And I'm wondering 9 years later if yours is still the only one.
Well, that's an interesting question because we've stayed in the same facility because we're delighted with what we do in that facility. I think there are a couple of brands that have gotten a little bit closer, but they tend to get closer, not in a complete sense, but in a partial sense. So there'll be some facilities that are nut-free. And so those brands can make a nut-free claim. They just can't make a gluten-free claim or a dairy-free claim. We make all those claims. Unfortunately, I think to our detriment as a brand, because you go up to sort of the highest common denominator, and that automatically gives you the smallest possible market, because the number of people who actually need all of those things that you are free of is quite small. Which is a little frustrating in the marketing sense.
Well, I'm glad you're out there. I don't have any of those allergies, but I like your chocolate because it's organic, it's vegan, and I know people that have one or two of those things. I like to cook for people, and this is just the easiest, safest choice. And also, I just want to add, because I spoke to you 9 years ago, I heard your story, and I trust you. You're one of the few people who has a company that I feel is trustworthy. You don't know what's going on in so many, especially the big companies. And then you hear about all these scandals that happen. They're trying to be efficient and cut costs and whatever. And it's scary. It's a leap of faith to buy anything in a package.
Well, I appreciate the vote of confidence, and certainly the trustworthiness and the transparency is something that we work very hard to achieve. Partly we can do that because of the way that we operate. The chocolate supply chain is very complicated and generally full of multiple steps. So if you were to try and trace what happens to that cocoa bean once it leaves the tree and all the different steps and companies and people that it goes through by the time it gets to an end product on the shelf that you're buying, it's multiple components in there. What we do is we've actually simplified that as much as we can. So where we make the chocolate down in Peru, the beans literally go off the tree directly into that chocolate factory. And that's generally a process of 30 to 60 days from when the pod is off the tree to when it's actually getting made into chocolate. So we've shortened the time and we've reduced the number of parties in the process. But then in that factory, when we're doing multiple steps of the chocolate making process, so it's not just roasting the beans and grinding the beans and making the liquor and making the bulk chocolate. It goes all the way through from literally. We call it from bean to bar, actually from tree to bar, because it's off the tree, straight into the plant, into the bar, wrapped, packaged, sealed. So we know that by the time we've got that sealed product, it's call it 60 days after that cocoa bean came off the tree, it's basically been nowhere other than in the truck from the growing region into the plant, processed all the way through the finished product at the plant, and then it's sealed. So you know what's happened to it. You know exactly, all the conditions surrounding it, and you've got 100% confidence and certainty in what that product is, which it's a nice position to be in. And then we bring it into our warehouse in the US and off the shelf. And again, it's got the fewest touch points of almost any brand out there, which I think is a useful thing in terms of traceability, confidence, trustworthiness. It's almost like you're buying it locally, except it's come 3,000 miles from the growing region.
Yeah, I love it. Keep it simple. There are so many foods, and I don't know how many people realize you mentioned the word traceability, but ingredients in a food product, it's insane to follow where each ingredient came from and then how it was grown, how it was shipped, and how they all kind of meet together in some kind of harmony at some other place. It could be it. Each ingredient could have traveled from several countries before it got to the place where it's made into something else. And to figure out what's in everything, and it's just a mess. So you're
I
smart,
think that
Timon.
I think that's why single origin is so interesting, because most chocolate is not single origin. If generally, if it is, it states that it is. Ours is both our brands are single origin chocolate products, one from Peru, the other from Ghana. But we just don't have that blending process, and within a blend, what's happened to it, where's it come from? It's very difficult to know. And from a consumer perspective, I think you want to know this. I was actually this is a bit of an aside, but I was recently buying some I was buying a new coffee machine big from a big Swiss company that makes interesting pods, and I was trying to find out what coffee was in these pods that I was buying, and I had the hardest time. You couldn't find all the packaging. I ended up in one of their stores and talking to one of the people there, and then he's got more knowledge, much more knowledge than is communicated on the packaging or on the website. But that was important to me. It's important from a taste perspective, a quality perspective, and I just think it's the same across all these food categories. People, this is 2024. We're in a much higher tech world than ever before. The data explosion is everywhere. Why can't we know? Why can't we understand? What's in it? Where's it come from? What are the different measures, quality measures that might be relevant to you as a consumer? Not just yes, the manufacturer signed off that this is okay quality wise, but back to your trans fat point. Maybe you want to know what the trans fat content is, or you want to know actually. What's the true dairy content of that chocolate that says it may contain? I think if you roll forward 10 years from now, I think the food industry, has to look a little bit different in terms of this information that gets communicated. And I think right now it's like it's kicking and screaming to try and hold on to old practices, but they have to change.
Technology is at a point where it really shouldn't be that difficult to
Exactly.
barcode everything from everywhere and keep track of where things are going. It shouldn't
Absolutely.
be that difficult.
Now, if I was really smart, I'd learn how to configure our business so that we could get to the head of that curve and add that information and make that information available
You are smart, and I think you can do this.
to... Well,
I
thanks for
remember.
the
I've been doing this podcast 15 years. Unfortunately, I don't remember everybody I've spoken to. You're one of the people that I won't forget. But I did talk to an author of a book. I forget the book and I forget the author, and I'll have to look that up afterwards. But the book had to do with, I think, a Trader Joe product where he wanted to find the origins of the ingredients. And I think walnuts might have been one of them. And just to find where they came from. It was this insane journey that turned into a book.
Yes. Well, and companies don't want to disclose it. They don't want, generally, they don't want you to know, because they want the freedom to do what they need to do to cut the costs or to whatever it is. And the more they can kind of keep consumers away from that information, the easier their life is. But
And an informed consumer can be really trouble for a company.
yes, well, they can be troubled, but they can also be the great. They can also be champions, because if you've got good things, truly good things about your product, and consumers get to realize that, and they're going to go and tell everybody about it. They're going to just sing your
I
praise.
do that with Pasha.
Right, thank you. But it's like if you go to a restaurant or something, and you're talking to the chef. And you say, well, I really enjoyed that. Tell me what was in it. He's going to tell you exactly, well, I got this meat from here, or I got this whatever, not just the way he's cooked it, but he'll disclose whatever you, and that's part of the journey and the experience and the pleasure of that occasion. And I think the food industry's just got to get there as well.
Now, the few times I've reached out to you to ask you a chocolate question, you're either coming or going or somewhere else. You seem to be traveling a lot. So I assume some of it has to do with the chocolate. And
Oh,
you've mentioned Peru and Ghana. So where have you been going and how have things changed over the last? When did you start, Pasha?
2012, end of
2012.
2012.
Okay, so it's
We're about
been
12 years
12
in.
years.
We launched in early 2013, so that's been 10 years. So I generally, and we make all of Pasha at the moment in Peru. We did for a while make some of it in the UK, but currently it's entirely made in Peru. I get down to Peru 2 or 3 times a year, and that's I love the country. I love the factory. I love the people. It's just a very, uplifting thing, because as a factory and as a supply chain, they believe in what we're doing. They're committed to it, and so it's just a very it's a great experience. Peru is also a fascinating country. There's an amazing diversity of food, and the cooking standards, and the you go to a restaurant, the fusion, or to us, it's fusion. The way that they combine ingredients and think about food, it's just different and fascinating. So it's always good. More recently, I've been going to Switzerland a lot, because we've created this new brand, which we've got quite high hopes for. We've made this particular point of saying, why is all the healthier, better for you chocolate, dark chocolate? If you want to get a better, cleaner milk chocolate, what do? You go into any store and there's nothing. It's kind of milk or milk. But in the milk category, there's about 40 or 50% of the population who are using different plant milks, in their coffees or cereals or whatever it is. So why should that not be relevant to chocolate? And we think it is. So we've introduced this new line called Lovo, which uses different plant milks to make different types of plant milk-based chocolate. And we had to go to Switzerland because I'm a little biased, but I think the Swiss make the best dairy milk chocolate in the world. I think that the flavor and expertise, I mean, it's where milk chocolate was invented. Their knowledge of it is extraordinary. And I say that as somebody who started his life with Cadbury's in England, a very different way of making milk chocolate, but I think the Swiss is better. So we went to Switzerland to get these products made, and we formulated these plant milk chocolate products. And they are, to my mind, they're just delicious, and creating a new cleaner, healthier, better for you way of looking at milk chocolate. So you can have your milk chocolate experience, but you don't have to have the dairy. And it's not just because of allergies, but the environmental consequences of the dairy industry, and the ridiculous amounts of water that's used, and I mean, it's crazy. It makes no sense. I think more and more people understand that just directionally reducing the dairy they consume is a good thing, in so many ways. And I think the chocolate industry needs to get there as well. It needs to be part of that plant-based movement. So that's what we're trying to do with that. We've got some great guys we're working with in Switzerland who are really, really innovative with the way they've worked with these plants to get these new recipes.
Lovely. So you're using nut milks in these
Yeah,
chocolates?
almond milk and coconut milk, hazelnut milk, and oat milk. Looking at a couple more, and each one's different. It's like milk chocolate, but it's just got that little flavor of those different nut milks. And it's like nothing else that's out there. It's really I guess I'm biased, because I love milk chocolate, but I can't really milk. And these bars are just perfect. I'm biased.
There are some plant-based milk products that are made with a manufactured casein, manufactured milk proteins. I don't know if you've thought about them. I hope you're not going to consider them because I like you, if you have a dairy allergy, you're going to have a reaction to them.
Yeah, you're recreating the protein structure in some way. And why?
Exactly
Why do you
why?
need to do that? There are better, easier solutions that are out there that are just as delicious or more so, actually. I would take our hazelnut milk chocolate and put it up against any milk chocolate anywhere. It's just it's
So
sensational.
good. I've seen the Lovo products. I didn't realize they were yours, but I'm gonna run and find some.
Well, and so that was because we've got the Pasha line, which is so completely allergen friendly and pure. We didn't want to confuse our Pasha customers by connecting the Lovo brand to Pasha. People thinking, well, wait a minute, are you making Lovo in the same factory? Does it mean you've got the almonds going next? No, it doesn't.
No.
It was just easier to keep them separate in terms of communication. So,
Okay, you've heard that here, everybody. They are completely separate, different countries. That's separate.
different countries, different ways of making chocolate, different techniques, different I mean, getting too technical, but different crystal structures in the actual
Ooh.
chocolate that gives a different flavor component. So,
I like that. We are seeing the impact of climate change. It's affecting all of our lives. It's affecting our food, our farming. And how is it affecting our cocoa beans?
Well, I half wish we could have had this conversation 6 months ago because it would have been a very different answer. But right now, the chocolate industry is going through absolute turmoil because of the price of cocoa beans, which has gone up 350% in the last 12 months. So, a year ago, a metric ton of cocoa beans would be the market price was roughly $2,500. About 2 weeks ago, it just touched $10,000. Why? Because 80%, 70, 80% of the world's supply of cocoa beans comes from two countries, Ghana and the Ivory Coast. And both of those countries are suffering from severe crop reductions because of climate change. Not just climate change, also an underinvestment through time in the right agrarian practices. It's still an old way of working that is not really focused enough on sustainability in the cocoa growing practices out there, and you combine, decades of underinvestment and poor practices. You throw climate change on top of that, and suddenly you've got, I think there's like a 30% reduction at the moment in the Ivory Coast. The second crop in Ghana this year, the slightly smaller crop is due to have a 50% reduction. These are material changes to the supply of cocoa beans in the world. And the way the bean market works, it's a globally traded commodity, and you can buy, the cash price, and there's a different structures of futures prices. But what that means is that people can come in and they can forward buy these different contracts, and they can sort of take out the supply. And so if people see, price exploding, it does two things. The suppliers into that market are going to hold supply back because they're waiting for the price to go up. And people who are in the market are going to try and buy forward because they're afraid that the price is going to go up. So you get this, the way the market works, it's compounding the problem because it's further restricting supply, further increasing short-term demand. And that's created this just ridiculous situation of 350% increase in the cost of cocoa beans. Yeah, what's changed in their underlying costs for the farmer? Nothing. So the farmers are very happy. What's frustrating about it from a manufacturer's standpoint is that if you take that cost increase in the cocoa beans, if you would average that out over the last 20 years, you might end up with a fairly acceptable sort of rate of growth. You could certainly say that $2,500 a year ago, which is where the price had been almost forever, with a minor variation around that, that was not a reasonable price. But the market wasn't functioning in a way to allow that gradual price increase to come through over time. So suddenly we got hit with this huge sort of tsunami of cost increase in the cocoa bean market. What's that going to do? Well, as soon as the supply chain works its way through, it's going to hit the shelf. It's not got there yet. It's beginning to. It's just beginning to come through. But the general consumer price, shelf price of chocolate has not moved in a material way. On our Pasha business, because we work in such a pure way, we make a product with 100% cocoa, 85% cocoa. That's our key ingredient. We use as little sugar as we possibly can. So it has an enormous impact on our business, and that whole specialty area is going to be badly affected. So the price, retail prices are going to go up a lot. Then we'll see, how much do people really want that chocolate? The same thing's happened in a whole bunch of food categories, and olive oil is a good example at the moment. The price of olive oil today is, dramatically higher than it was a year ago. But, if you're cooking, what are you going to do? Are you really going to substitute for a different oil? Or do you say it's a must-have, and so you keep consuming it? But chocolate's not quite the same thing. It's not a, it's a much more of a an impulse discretionary item. So what's going to happen to market volumes? I honestly have no idea, but it's very troubling for all the specialty companies in particular, well, the whole industry. Very, very concerned. I think our consumer prices will at least double by the middle of this year. And if you buy a bag of our chocolate chips, they've been typically $5.99, $6.99. They're going to be way over $10. We'll be $11.99, $12.99, and that's if the price holds here and doesn't keep on going.
Okay, I'm now thinking I gotta buy a few cases.
Exactly, because that's part of the process, and that compounds the problem.
No, I know it compounds the problem, but that's how we're thinking. But we do this in all markets. We hear there's going to be a bad storm and everybody cleans off the shelves. COVID was a nightmare. Everybody was hoarding all these things. But what's really unfair is, so those of us who have the means can play this game and do these things. But what's happening to the people in Ghana? It's not just chocolate, it's got to affect their food supply as well.
Well, if you're a cocoa farmer in Ghana, you're kind of happy right now because you're finally getting a price increase for the crop to grow, which is very necessary. There's a real silver lining to this, which is that those farmers are going to actually end up getting a much more reasonable, equitable, payment for their product. I mean, there's fair trade, which has been around forever, but without delving too deeply into that, fair trades existed, but still these farmers have been suffering. And finally, with this cost increase that's coming through, they're going to end up, I think in Ivory Coast recently, they just increased the price to the farmer for his cocoa beans by 50% because it's a government controlled process in the Ivory Coast. So they're now getting 50% more. That's a
Wow.
material impact
Yeah.
on these farms. And I think that's extremely positive. And at a consumer end, there's all sorts of issues with the chocolate industry in terms of, how much chocolate should people consume, how much sugar should people consume, total caloric intake. Well, if you've actually got to pay a little bit more for it, then maybe you just think a little bit harder about what you really want, what you really need, how much you're prepared to consume, etc. And that is, maybe no bad thing. That's me taking a consumer's hat rather than my, company hat, where I just want more volume. But, from a global sort of standard of both supply and demand, maybe it's not such a bad thing.
I like that. So we've known for a long time that there are these commodity foods, cocoa, coffee, sugar, that are made in countries that are not as affluent as the Western nations, and they get shipped to us who have the means and like to consume them. And there's always been this downside where they're not making enough food for their own people, or they're not making what they need. So there was this dark side to commodity foods like cocoa and coffee and sugar. So what you're saying is good. Maybe it's all going to work itself out. They can make a more livable wage, and it's a treat. We
So,
should treat it like a treat.
having just complained about the market and the way it's working, maybe actually it's just the market catching up. And in a global sense, that's not a bad thing because a lot of catch
Right.
up was necessary. So maybe the market is finally doing what it should do to sort of shore up the sources of supply, and it provides the margin to allow more sustainable agrarian practices because the farmers see, oh, I can make more. Because the prices have gone up, therefore I'll invest more, and I will, change the way that I'm working. I won't need to, not to get into the slave labor debate, but I won't need to, get children into my farm to lower the wage cost within my farming structure, because I can afford to actually pay people the wage that they should get for working on the farm. So all the way through, you can see some real interesting benefits that come out of this.
We're seeing this in so many industries. California just passed their $20 an hour minimum wage, and as a result, people are going to have to pay more for their fast food. The delivery industry right now is a disaster, and I'm hoping that will change. But we have to learn that we can't get everything for nothing.
No, that's
Everybody
right.
needs a livable wage.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And consumption just needs to be a little bit more thoughtful. And if it takes pricing to encourage people to be more thoughtful about what they consume and how they consume it, maybe that's no bad thing. One of the things I'm hoping is that, as people start to pay more for chocolate, they actually say, okay, if I've got to pay more for it, then what am I actually paying for? It's not just oh, that's cheap, I'll grab it. It's like, oh, okay, I'm gonna pay $10 for that. Okay, now what do I want for my $10? How clean do I want that chocolate to be? How much traceability do I need, etc. So I think there's hopefully a silver lining for those of us who really care about what we do.
Back to Pasha. So you started in 2012, 2013. How have you grown? I've seen it's a little more available in the places that I look. I'm
Yeah.
in health food stores. I go to Vitacost sometimes. They distribute it.
I think when you go to market, you don't know what your market is, and it takes you a while to find it. It's just a matching process, finding your people, your consumers, your retailers, your distributors, finding the things that work and the things that don't work. Just being very candid with you, we have had much more success on the baking chip side of our business than we have on the confectionery side of our business. We find that with an ultra clean ingredient such as we have, it's very relevant for people's baking needs. So when we sell in a chocolate chip form, we really do quite well. We've been quite successful with that. When we sell that same chocolate formulation in a chocolate bar, even though we know that chocolate is delicious because it's utterly clean and pure, there are still too many consumers who will look at that bar and say, oh, it's free from all those things. It can't taste as good. It's just a natural reaction. I love eating pasta. If I see pasta that's gluten-free, I won't pick it up. I won't even try it. It could well be delicious. I just assume it won't be. It's irrational. It's just how we behave as
Of course,
consumers.
because chocolate doesn't have gluten in it. Chocolate's not made with wheat, really. It just is contaminated.
But when the minute you think you've taken some things out,
Yeah,
well,
that's
it can't
funny.
be as good. It can't be as delicious. I mean, you're buying a chocolate bar, you just want that instant deliciousness. And I think with our bar business, too many people have made the assumption that actually it can't taste like good. So they'll carry on buying what they bought
I'll
before.
tell you why I like the chips. I mean, I like them all, but we buy a lot of chips because I don't like to eat just chocolate. So sometimes I'll make a mix with chocolate and raisins and nuts, or sometimes I'll just want a tiny little bit, a couple, two or three pieces. And the chips are easy. And my partner Gary, he really tries to avoid caffeine. He'll have it occasionally, but you have the white chocolate chip, which has really been a game changer for him. Because there's not a lot of vegan white chocolate chips out there.
There's not a lot, and I think we're on our third formulation iteration at the moment. It's still a never-ending quest to get that white vegan chocolate to the level we want to get it to. And I can't, hand on heart, tell you I'm completely satisfied with where it's at. It's better than anything else that I'm aware of, but I still think there's a couple of things we're working on that I think could be very interesting to
Is
tweak that.
I know I want to focus on Pasha, but are you working on a Lovo white chocolate? Does that exist?
You
Okay. You don't want to
read me
answer that
mine.
question. You're pleading
Yes.
the fifth.
Ple
Okay.
ple ple pleading the fifth, but what an interesting line of inquiry.
Yeah, okay. Very good. So let's see. Do we have anything else to cover here? How's your family? Everybody good?
Family, great. Growing up too quickly. It's just my eldest daughter just turned 20. And it feels like yesterday that it was, she was just emerging. So I don't know what happened to the last 20 years.
Right, but she's reading labels on food.
She is manically reading labels, and she went off to university, and she's now living in a house, and she suddenly discovered that she's got to cook, and it's like you've thrown them into the swimming pool, and they've got to swim, and she's doing it, and she's cooking healthily and choosing her ingredients and what she buys. It's fantastic. We're so proud of her.
I'm happy to hear that. Well, Simon, thank you for taking the time and joining me and talking about chocolate. It's just such a great thing to talk about.
Such a fun topic, such a complex topic, but always happy to talk to you.
Just one last question. What's your favorite way to have chocolate?
Well, I'm in the industry. One of the reasons I'm in the industry is because I'm essentially a chocoholic, and the chocoholism, if that's the right word, really it's eating a bar, not necessarily the whole bar, but eating chocolate in a bar form, the pure bar form of chocolate. To me, it's like an art form. It's up on a pedestal of one of the world's great sort of culinary pleasures. And so if I can get a bar of great chocolate, it's kind of as good as it gets.
Okay. I'm going to go get some right now. Simon Lester, Pasha Chocolate, thank you so much for joining me. And I look forward to speaking with you again soon with more chocolate news.
Thank you.
Okay. Take care. Bye bye.
Bye.
Okay, everybody. I think I've made it clear that I am a fan of Pasha. And in these last few minutes, I just want to continue extolling the wonders of this product. If you go to their website, PashaChocolate.com, and that's PASCHA chocolate.com, there is a page that talks about what's not in our chocolate. And I want to highlight some of those things. It says, "We're doing the opposite of almost everything the mainstream candy industry does to chocolate. What's not in their chocolate?" They list a number of things: dairy, soy, peanuts, tree nuts, eggs, wheat and gluten, fish and crustaceans, celery, mustard, sesame, lupins, sulfates, corn. None of our products, it says, contain corn as an ingredient, but if you're concerned about corn, please note the following: the vegan white chocolate bar and chips and vegan no milk chocolate, currently chips only, use a vanilla extract that is spray dried on organic maltodextrin that has been sourced from organic corn. They are so transparent. And the no added sugar chocolate with stevia uses organic erythritol that was derived from organic corn. Now, the corn is related to the white chocolate only. Pascha does not contain pesticides. It's an organic chocolate. I just want to remind you that many chocolates out there, many of the mainstream brands, are very likely to contain pesticides or residues from pesticides. Mycotoxins. It says various studies over the last decade have shown the presence of mycotoxins like aflatoxin and acrotoxin in chocolate. These are toxins produced from fungi that can be carcinogenic. The mycotoxin production is linked to farming practices, especially with damaged cocoa pods, where mold toxins can accumulate. This can be avoided with good farming practices, separating infected pods and harvesting ripe pods at the right time. At Pascha, we test our chocolate for aflatoxins and acrotoxins. The upper limit of aflatoxins is 10 ppb, parts per billion, and for acrotoxins, it is a max of 5 ppbs. They go on talking about emulsifiers. Most chocolate is made with emulsifiers, compounds that act to help bind the fat and sugar within the chocolate so the viscosity can be maintained and the chocolate will flow well and be easier to handle. The most widely used emulsifier is soy lecithin. Studies now show emulsifiers can be inflammatory and carcinogenic, but with chocolate, we don't actually have to use it. We can manage the viscosity of the chocolate by using extra cocoa butter, swapping a healthy fat for an inflammatory and natural ingredient. At Pascha, we do not use any emulsifiers in our chocolate. And I love cocoa butter. I like to use it on my skin because it smells so yummy. I also want to continue reading this because as I'm reading it, I'm learning. And I hope you are too. The next category is Dutch alkalized chocolate. Pascha does not use Dutch cocoa in any product. All Pascha chocolate bars and baking chips are made from cocoa beans, not cocoa powder. Dutch cocoa powder has an added alkalizing agent added to lower the acidity, which changes the flavor profile of the cocoa, making it less bitter and darkens the color. But the processing of the powder with the alkalizing agent reduces the flavanol content of the cocoa. Natural cocoa can typically have around 35 milligrams per gram of flavanols, whereas heavily processed Dutch cocoa powders can be around 4 milligrams per gram, significantly less flavanols. And here's another interesting topic that they include on raw chocolate. Pascha is not and never will be raw chocolate. Several brands of raw chocolate or raw cocoa powder have appeared over the last few years, promising higher levels of flavanols due to lower temperature processing. At Pascha, we want to use high flavanol cocoa beans, which we can roast to a level we know to be safe from any lingering microbiological activity. Aside from making the cocoa beans safe, roasting also develops the flavor of the cocoa bean, just as in coffee. No raw chocolate for us. Well, that's interesting, right? It goes on talking about colors, preservatives, and artificial flavorings, which they do not and never will use. All their flavors and colorings are natural and come from the ingredients themselves. They continue saying our shelf life is dictated by the purity of ingredients and the chocolate making process. I love that. Okay, here is a very, very important topic, slave labor. And he touched on this when we spoke. It says, over the last decade, the chocolate industry has developed a reputation for using forced child labor in West African cocoa plantations, with children shipped across borders, sometimes knowingly by their families, to work in large industrial-sized plantations, living and working in terrible conditions. The process of harvesting cocoa pods is still a manual one of cutting the ripe pods from the trees, and the cheaper and faster this can be done, the more money the plantation owner can make. Pasha does not source from any farm that uses slave labor. All of our cocoa beans come from Peru in Latin America, where the social structure of the growing region is completely different. In Latin America, the farms are almost all small and family-owned. If the cocoa farmer's children work on the farm, it's under the eye of the parent helping out the family business. Pasha is also Rainforest Alliance certified, and this means the farmers have to sign formal contracts committing to social standards, including no use of forced child labor. And lastly, full sun cocoa growing. Pasha cocoa beans come from shade-grown trees, grown on farms committed to high ecological standards that are required by their UTZ Rainforest Alliance certification. There is an increasing problem in many cocoa-growing regions from large-scale deforestation, removing all tree cover to allow more cocoa trees to be planted with more direct sunlight exposure. In the short term, the yields are good, but without the shade and biodiversity of other tree types around soil, quality is depleted. There is more crop disease and cocoa bean quality suffers. Pasha is committed to sound farming practices that preserve biodiversity, maintain cocoa bean quality, and looks after the cocoa growing regions we source from in a sustainable way. Are you a believer yet? I love this chocolate. I think it's delicious, and I love that it doesn't contain all these extra ingredients, and that it's just chocolate, the way chocolate should be made. It's something you can believe in, and I'm excited about that. People need to learn from Simon Lester to care about their product. Okay, it's not a big company. It's not a big chain, and in many ways, smaller is better. Now, where can you get Pasha chocolate? Their website will lead you to all the products that they have. I use the company Vitacost. You say Vitacost, I say Vitacost. Vitacost.com sells a lot of products that either I don't find in local stores or I just find it convenient to do a big order and have it shipped to my home. And they frequently have different sales that I like so I can shop competitively. And I often get my Pasha dark chocolate and white chocolate chips there. And you can likely find Pasha in local health food stores. In hindsight, I'm wishing I asked Simon about cocoa powder. I like to make a hot beverage that I've created. It's kind of like a hot cocoa. I don't often sweeten it, but I find it delightful. I'll take 2 tablespoons of cocoa powder and add 1/2 cup of water and whisk it together. And then I have this lovely little frothing machine and I'll whip into a frenzy some 1/2 cup of soy milk. And sometimes I'll add a little vanilla to that. Sometimes I'll add 1 tablespoon of maple syrup if I'm feeling really in a decadent mood. I might add 2 tablespoons. Woo-hoo-hoo. And I'll mix that all together, and it's just this creamy, lovely thing. But sometimes I don't add any sweetener. And I like chocolate or cocoa without a sweetener. It's kind of like when people have coffee without sugar. It's a rich, dark, somewhat bitter drink that I find very delicious. And how many of you know the difference between hot cocoa and hot chocolate? And I'm thinking I might have to make a hot chocolate with Pasha chocolate. So hot chocolate is actually made with the chocolate bar. Hot cocoa is supposed to be made with cocoa powder. Actual hot chocolate is quite decadent. Melting the chocolate with hot water to make a very thick, drinkable beverage. And depending on your taste, you can use a bitter chocolate or a dark chocolate or a sweet chocolate. And you can add sugar if you like, cinnamon, different flavorings to it. Colombian hot chocolate, for example, uses cinnamon, cloves, and even cheese with a hint of salt, which I don't recommend unless it's vegan cheese. That does not sound good, does it? And the Italian hot chocolate includes cornstarch to thicken it. which doesn't sound very interesting to me. And the European style uses the unsweetened cocoa powder or dark chocolate or bittersweet chocolate. I've read that hot cocoa is thinner than hot chocolate, which can be really thick, made from the solid chocolate. But when I make hot cocoa, it's pretty thick because I use a good amount of cocoa powder and not so much water, and then it gets thicker. Boing. Chocolate is a treat. There are some good things in chocolate, like magnesium, flavanols, but it's a treat. And very often, chocolate travels many distances to get to our homes. And as Simon mentioned, the cost is going up of chocolate. And I would like to think at some point globally, since we're a global society, we can get to a point where everyone around the world is paid a livable wage for their work so they can live comfortably, send their children to school, and be comfortable in their senior years. The world doesn't work that way right now. There are tremendous gaps in the economy with very wealthy and very poor, and we're seeing that gap get bigger. So I'm finding this little bit of news about chocolate somewhat encouraging, that the cost is going to go up. Some of the people that are making it will benefit and be able to live a more comfortable life, and that's a good thing. Just remember, chocolate's a treat, and it's not essential for survival, but it is delicious and very nice to have. That's our program for today. I hope you've enjoyed it and learned a few things. I know I have. I'm Karen Hartglass, the host of It's All About Food since 2009. Find me at my nonprofit website, responsibleeatingandliving.com, where you can find hundreds of recipes, including recipes with chocolate, and all of the It's All About Food shows since 2009 are archived there. Have a delicious week, everybody.